Like Stout Cortez, with eagle eyes, he stared at the Pacific, and all his men looked at each other with wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, located in the sister city of Nanjing, China, London, Ontario, Canada. Now, I mention our fair Chinese sister city because for space exploration, just like for municipalities, there are advantages to teaming up. And no one knows that better than tonight's guest, David Southwood. In his role as the Director of Science and Robotic Exploration at the European Space Agency, Professor Southwood managed the contributions and priorities for space science betwixt and between 19 member states, as well as spearheading ESA's cooperation with NASA and other space agencies the world over. Under his watch, the number of planetary missions at ESA and the science that they have returned have both increased to the point that today, euro for euro, ESA is just as capable as NASA when it comes to exploring our solar system. Let us not forget, however, that Professor Southwood is also a distinguished scientist, having taken part in planetary magnetometry since the early 1970s. He was a part of the team that discovered direct evidence of present-day liquid water beneath the surface of Europa, and led the Cassini magnetometer that, even now, continues to collect data at Saturn. With such experience comes the privilege of choosing the evening's quotation, and I have deferred to David's choice of Keats. Now, a few weeks ago, in our interview with Paul Wiegert, you heard half of On First Looking into Chapman's Homer, but the ending is even more poignant than the quote that we use there. As David painted the image for me, imagine a navigator arriving in southern Panama after crossing the Atlantic. To properly appreciate this new territory, the navigator and all his crew trek inland before climbing a mountain to get their bearings. But the view that awaits them at the top of the hill is not the end of their discovery. Instead, it is the inception of future journeys, held captive within the mind's eye as it stares into the boundless blue expanse of the Pacific Ocean, glimpsed for the first time. Our scientific exploration of the solar system is the same. Though we see through the eyes of our robotic probes, the vista revealed is, for ourselves, no less immediate. Each journey opens up new pathways of exploration. Each answer begs new questions, and, through it all, we are awed both at the complexity of our sister worlds and at our ability, through our technology, to make the unknown known. It was a privilege for me to be able to speak to one of the architects of that knowledge base and to share that conversation with you. Given the expertise of our guest, it is appropriate that transitioning us through the program tonight is Howard Shore's Evenstar from The Lord of the Rings, a composition that subtly honors two of the planets on which our guest has worked. At the same time, I can only hope that this evocative music gives you a taste for what both David and I have felt standing on that peak of discovery. Without further ado, let us transition to my interview with Professor Southwood. Professor Southwood, you've had the opportunity to work on the Sun and just about every one of the classical planets, all the way from Mercury out to Saturn. What really stands out amid all of that?
Well, from a personal perspective, I have to say Saturn is the one that has fascinated me. Just about 30 years ago, I was one of the few European scientists who met with a bunch of American scientists at JPL to discuss the possibilities of doing something at the time we called SOTP, Saturn Orbiter Titan Probe. Well, that became the much more musical Cassini-Huygens, and 30 years is a long time. Now, of course, I've done lots of other things as well as work on Cassini-Huygens. But if I look back on my career, Cassini-Huygens was absolutely the thing. I'm just so happy. I happened to be in the right place at the right time and right at the beginning. The 30 years have sped by, and what's beautiful about it is the spacecraft Cassini is still working. It is a wonderful machine. It is day and night, 24/24, 7/7, delivering data back. It's been perfect, and I'm almost superstitious about saying that. And then Huygens, which always was going to be a short-term activity, even that was about twice the length of data gathering than we expected. It was an enormously emotional event for me. We Europeans have known we would more likely be able to get it into the European program, because at the time, you understand, Europeans did not do planetary science. They could hitch a ride on American programs or whatever, but they didn't do their own thing. And we just knew you had to do something quite startling to kind of break the mold. And up to then, they had done Giotto, and that was it. And so, in fact, Giotto hadn't flown in 1982, but it was about to be launched. It worked. Everything worked. And for me, I don't mind about the rest of my career. I was involved in Cassini-Huygens. That's enough to say. So it really is head and shoulders. It's the Everest of the things I've been involved in.
Well, that's absolutely fabulous. And the Huygens lander, if I can call it that. Mm. I know leading up to the atmospheric entry, we were very superstitious about that, only called it an atmospheric probe. But what it found on the surface, and with a beautiful UK surface science package, just amazing.
Yeah, the whole thing was magical, and I was lost for words. And my friend John Zarnicki, who built the surface science package, I remember we met, and we knew we were going to have to say something at a press conference, and we didn't want to sound like Americans. And Americans have this wonderful ability to go, wow, and yeah, and too much. One, just use extreme words. We wanted somehow to be a little more European. And so John and I said, poetry, we have to find a poem. And I went and looked up, I googled on the web, a poem about standing on a peak in Darien, which I remembered. I learnt it at school. And I gave this quotation of standing on a peak in Darien. And the idea is, Darien is Panama Isthmus, and the Spaniards have got to the peak, and they look out, and they see this whole new ocean. You know, they've come from the Atlantic, from the Caribbean. It's this whole new ocean of possibilities ahead of them. And that's how we felt. So I quoted this, and I attributed it to the poet Shelley. Unfortunately, it was written by Keats. I can tell you, I got an awful lot of emails from people who thought my knowledge of poetry should be better. I thought it was enough to quote poetry. And Al Diaz, who was the NASA Administrator for Science, Associate Administrator, he was in tears. So we were in this very high emotional state, and I've got to tell you, it's after that, I don't really mind what happens. It was the high point of my career and my life in some respects. Perhaps I shouldn't say that to my wife and family, but there you are.
It's a very good image. I mean, you get to the top. What's laid out before you said
that? What's interesting is the imminence of the situation. It's like you can see, you've got all this to explore ahead of you. And what we saw, because we'd never seen the surface of Titan, it had always been hidden by the smoggy atmosphere of Titan, a sort of orange planet because of the atmosphere. We saw there were rivers and there were lakes and there were mountains. We promised people there would be this sort of thing. But, a bit like those Spanish explorers, they probably made a similar promise, but seeing the promise revealed and realized, what we knew is it's going to be an absolute cornucopia of new results. And it's magical. It's Aladdin's cave.
Well, that's some fabulous stuff. And the European Space Agency has really come a long way since then as well.
It's right. It's, I mean, I was absolutely lucky to be the director at the point. When I became director, I think we had 5 spacecraft operating in science. We had lots of other spacecraft, but we had 5 science spacecraft operating. When I finished 10 years later, and it's not much to do with me because it's partly to do with the political imperative, all I had to do was ride the tiger. Really, it was this fact that we started seeing ourselves as number 2 behind NASA, it's true, but with our own role to play. And things like Giotto was important, but it took a while before we really had the confidence to feel we could do things, special things, on our own. But we had Mars Express, Venus Express, Smart One to the Moon. We've 3 big telescopes I launched, Integral Gamma Ray Telescope, Herschel and Planck, both in the infrared submillimeter, looking at star formation and so on. Really now, if you look, ESA is playing across the board, and that's an enormous difference. I take a little bit of credit for actually doing the management. But in a way, the seeds have been sown long before that. I just reaped the harvest, and boy, what a nice harvest it was to reap.
Well, staying with the European Space Agency for a minute, and sort of looking to the future, I know that a lot of budgets for space agencies especially are under pressure. This is especially true in the United States, where unfortunately there was a rather large cut to planetary science that was made, being discussed as we record this in Houston, Texas. How do things look from across the pond?
Well, I'm a booster of the United States as an engine of exploration in space. So the last thing I want to say is anything that in any way suggests I would denigrate them. I just feel immensely sad. For instance, in the last few years, one of the last things I did over the last 3 years was pull together with a chap called Ed Weiler, who was the associate administrator in NASA, more or less in parallel with me. We felt we had enough mutual trust and that we would in future have Mars exploration as a joint activity. It allowed us to seriously think of doing Mars sample return. Europe isn't going to do that on its own. Uncle Sam is not going to do it on its own. I think it has to be a global effort. But before you can get a global effort, you have to show that the 2 big partners can work together. And in a way, it was running up the flag and seeing if anyone else followed. What I never dreamt of was the US would be the first to falter. And it's been dreadfully disappointing to me, dreadfully disappointing to Ed Weiler, who retired last year from NASA, just like I retired from ESA. What I am proud of is the Europeans appear to be taking it on the chin, and they are not intending to simply say, oh, well, the Americans can't cooperate with us. You know, we want to do a lander in 2016 and an orbiter, or an orbiter in 16 as well, and then in 18 to have a rover that will do things that have yet to be done by anyone else, deep drilling, for example, you know, going down a couple of meters. We have our European things to add to what's been done at Mars by the Americans. Well, rather than saying, oh, well, we pack up shop and go home, instead, the reaction is Europe set off on the path of exploration of Mars. It's got a few lessons to learn on cooperation, and we're very sad to learn those lessons, but we have a commitment, and we're looking at cooperation with the Russians, of course. The luck of the Russians with Mars is absolutely atrocious, and so it's nice they still want to explore Mars, but I think we Europeans have learned, well, perhaps we first have to do something on our own. Now, sadly, we wouldn't have done Huygens on our own. We had to have the mothership to get there. But that's a lesson you learn. And what we're hoping, of course, is if we go on, keep our eye on the ball, go on showing our determination, the Americans will not want to be left out. And in a way, it's a little like a marriage. You always have these difficulties. If there's an underlying trust, you can pull back from any disaster. But I must say, I'm very disappointed with what's happened in the last few months.
Understandably. I remember hearing, you mentioned that 30-year odyssey to get Cassini flown, that there was a lot of that give and take from both sides to make sure that things stayed on track.
We had our crises, particularly with Cassini, was cancelled at one point, or at least effectively close to cancelled. There had to be a major, major descope, one that got rid of the scanning platform and meant the whole spacecraft has to raster to get an overall image of a large object.
That's right, in contrast to Voyager.
Yeah. On the other hand, what's beautiful is it worked. it just shows how clever those guys at JPL are. I mean, I was absolutely blown away by this fixing of the problem. But you've got to understand, the Europeans had to put on a lot of pressure to make sure that it was understood. We had committed to do something with the United States, and the United States, we felt, had committed to us. Now, you never sign in blood between nations. It's always as well as we are able. You know, it's according to funds, etc., etc. It's just there's a moral commitment. And, you know, we Europeans have an enormous faith in America's fundamental morality. Maybe it's a bit of a shock for us to find that they would renege on something that we can't sue them for, but where I think there is a sense of being let down. And with Cassini, we went through it, and they came up trumps. It was a wonderful example of cooperation between the two sides.
Well, hopefully there'll be some more collaboration in the future. It is good to hear that Trace Gas Orbiter might still go. I know that atmospheric scientists like myself are very keen to see, for instance, the methane discovery by Mars Express followed up on.
I can tell you, it was very important to have the Mars Express result consolidated in 2009 by NASA. But then the next question is, methane and water, they seem to be linked. Come on. I mean, you know, there are flashing lights saying, look at me. And Trace Gas Orbiter, for me, was strengths are, for me, absolutely clear. For me, this is a fundamental step before you start thinking of doing Mars sample return. If you thought of doing an Earth sample return, if you happen to be a Martian, where would you want to land? Well, probably not in the center of the Saudi Arabian desert. Not that there's anything wrong with Saudi Arabia. It's just not as interesting as, you know, landing in the middle of a rainforest. Or, you know, you want to know. And frankly, the Trace Gas Orbiter, for me, is a fundamental mapping in order to really home in on where exploration needs to be focused, because really, when you come to it, what is the exploration? The ultimate goal is to figure out what is producing methane, for example. Is it an organic process, a very primitive organic process, which still is organic, but still could, in some sense, we never know when chemical organic activity becomes life. I don't know, and I don't think anyone does quite, when you say, that's life. Whatever it is, we know that the organic activity is necessary before you get to the biological activity. And when it comes to it, you don't have to be a scientist. You don't have to be a planetary enthusiast to understand, boy, this is really important. This is a planet that started off maybe a billion years after the solar system formed. You took a look at Mars and Earth and Venus, and they'd all look the same. You wouldn't have to bet which one was going to produce life. Earth clearly won the game, as far as we can tell at the moment. Venus appears to be out of the race. Mars, well, maybe in the past it had life, because it certainly had a wet history. But then you get nervous. We live on a very wet planet. What if we lost all our water? You know, what if, you know, for me, you don't have to, it's a no-brainer. It's so clear that the exploration of Mars is something that should interest everybody, not just for inspiration, but just out of self-preservation. You know, the Earth's a nice place to live. Mars is not. So let's try and figure out what happened there, what might happen here, and just be sure that we really understand things better.
Well, sort of staying on that topic of life and origins and understanding how you get from one system to another, another hotbed of life in the solar system is out in these icy moons, Europa and the ones also...
Yeah, I think the jury is out on the hotbed. What you mean is a hot possibility for life or whatever, partly because liquids are terrific for mixing things up. What I think most people would agree is to get anything as complicated as you and I, there's an awful lot of churning around of things that has to happen before you can really say that you've got life. And so there is something extremely appealing about water, particularly water, for the life forms we know, and its capacity to churn around, be moved around, because it just helps chemical processes take place, and ultimately will helps biological processes take place. It's fundamental to how things work on Earth. and let's assume it's fundamental elsewhere. So we've got Enceladus, something I never thought I would say until a few years ago. Something, in fact, the first suggestion there was something dramatic happening at Enceladus came out of the magnetometer on Cassini, so it's something that kind of I feel a certain personal involvement in the...
Sure, it's your own instrument.
Yeah, my own instrument on Cassini, in the sort of gestation of the idea. Of course, then you've got to take images, and the images, of course, Geiser's unbelievable magic. And then we have potentially internal oceans in Europa and Jupiter, and, you know, there's a possibility at Ganymede also. These icy moons have a lot of water in them. Are they, do they have processes, dissipative processes, effective enough to turn that water into liquid and gas? That's something where the jury's out. I think it takes us back to the need to explore the outer solar system still, and particularly, I would say, Jupiter moons. You know, beyond our exploration that's ongoing at Saturn.
Definitely. And I don't think that we can overstate that. I mean, we do have the geologic evidence on the surface of Europa, but the main direct evidence that we have water on the interior right now comes from the magnetometer here.
Indeed, it comes out of the fact that as the field of Jupiter interacts with the interior of Europa, it makes a magnetic signal that is best explained by saying there's some liquid, there's a moving liquid conducting fluid in there which is providing that magnetic signal. It's a unique way to look at things, and that's also where the suspicion that Ganymede might have something comes from. You know, magnetism's a bit dull to many people. You know, it kind of, you can't picture it. It's a dark energy, if you like. It's hidden away, but boy, is it important. And in fact, I took up magnetometry. I wanted to be a space scientist. That was kind of number one priority. But I also wanted to be involved in space missions. And I figured, if you look statistically, the number of magnetometers to have to fly, you can't imagine doing a mission to Jupiter or Saturn without a magnetometer. A solar mission must have a magnetometer, etc. Well, hey, I get into magnetometry. It's interesting in itself, but it's something that will open up lots of different possibilities for being involved in space missions, but at the same time doing interesting science. It was a gamble, you know, not much of a gamble. It was a pretty good runner for me. It certainly made my career very enjoyable, with a lot of work on magnetic fields in various situations around the Earth originally. And I used to deploy magnetometers when I was young on the surface of the Earth with my colleagues to look at the magnetism in the atmosphere and the upper atmosphere of the Earth. But then, you know, I've been involved in various missions, and I guess particularly the outer planets. I mean, Galileo and Cassini are for me very interesting magnetic environments. And we never would have predicted it if we hadn't gone there and made the measurements.
And like you say, a magnetometer is a great piece of equipment for taking on a space mission. It's small, low power, has all the attributes that you want.
Plus,
to fly.
It is needed to order many of the other measurements made. There's no point measuring charged particles. Charged particles are very important in the environment of Saturn and Jupiter. They determine an awful lot. They determine the aurora and an awful lot else that goes on. And they, measuring them without knowing the magnetic field is not very sensible. The magnetic field structures the charged particle distributions, and you can really say making measurements of charged particles without magnetic fields doesn't make much sense.
You mentioned the interaction of Jupiter's magnetic field with Europa and with Ganymede, but you also get beautiful light shows from the interaction of the Earth's magnetic field with the solar wind.
Absolutely. I mean, sitting here in Canada, in Toronto, well, we maybe need to go a bit further north, and the skies are very clear at the moment. That's an unusual phenomenon in Toronto, but it's great to be. In fact, I'm going from Toronto up to Alberta, and I must say, I'm hoping to see the aurora up there in Edmonton, but we'll see. I mean, for me, the aurora, I just love it. It's, if you've ever seen it, you know, as an atmospheric phenomenon or an astronomical phenomenon, it's a sort of combination of the two. It's the sun interacting with the Earth. You see these curtains, you see this sort of slow, it really is like curtains slowly evolving across the sky, dancing. I don't know, it's artistic. I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, it's awe-inspiring. The scale of it, the first scientists who tried to measure where the aurora was had no conception it was so far away or how big it was. You know, it's actually takes place, you know, 100 kilometers above you, and that's a hell of a long way up there, but it kind of looks like it's there, it's with you. I don't know, look, there are whole mythologies and poetry and so on written about the aurora. If you've ever seen it, you understand immediately why. And why, even though you don't hear any music when you see it, you feel music. It does look like it's dancing. I find that, you know, in a natural phenomenon, you know, there are plenty of other phenomena like that in nature, but it's one of the most dramatic things.
It's true, and it's putting on quite a show right now with the active part in the solar cycle. So for our listeners in northern parts of Canada, Scandinavia, New Zealand, and Tasmania, keep an eye out for it. I believe you're also president-elect of the Royal Astronomical Society. Can you tell us a little bit about that group?
Yes, I mean, that's the professional astronomy body in Britain, although I actually probably once a month of that order talk to amateur astronomers. It's one of the things I really enjoy doing, and I honestly think, for me, it's a way of saying thank you to taxpayers, because, you know, I never would have done all the things I've been able to do without taxpayers' dollars, and talking to amateur astronomers is a way of really... These people understand how important it is what we're doing. It's nice to talk to them and to sort of feel, you know, there are people out there who really care what we are doing to explore and improve our understanding of the solar system and indeed of the way the Earth and Sun interact. So the Royal Astronomical Society was founded by William Herschel, an astronomer in 1820, first president, and he was the man who discovered infrared light. So it's very important, because astronomy also, in my view, fine, it's inspirational, it's about the universe beyond, etc., but it also is very practical. There's hardly a person on this planet that doesn't, in their daily life, now come across the use of infrared light. That was an astronomical discovery. It was a discovery William Herschel made in 1800 by measuring the light of the sun and seeing that it was hottest beyond the visible spectrum. You break up the light using a prism, you get the rainbow of colors, like in, from blue through to red. And then beyond the red, he moved a thermometer, and the bulb went on getting hotter. That was astronomy. It was a kind of curiosity-driven experiment, and certainly just about the sun, and which is a pretty typical star. And yet today, the idea we don't use in myriad ways, in ways William Herschel wouldn't have dreamt of, infrared light is very important. So for me, I know it's nice to think of astronomers as somehow privileged people in ivory towers. What they're doing has a great relevance to understanding things, but also once you've understood things, we human beings are creative and imaginative enough to then do all sorts of other things that are not dreamt of by the original discoverers. So I'm very resentful against any suggestion astronomy isn't actually something with practical ends. And I think that's perceived by the typical amateur astronomer. They know that they're touching the infinite, but at the same time, they're aware that if people like them hadn't been worrying about the infinite that they looked up when they look up at the sky, frankly, we'd still be living in the caves. And I think, on the whole, life is better now.
I have just one more question for you. What advice would you have for sort of younger people who are looking to go into planetary science, into exploration technologies, heliophysics, these space-oriented fields?
Do it. I mean, I've been lucky enough. I'm, you know, in my 60s, late 60s now. So I've had a career spent as the universe has kind of expanded because of space discoveries. I mean, particularly in planetary science. I mean, you can't imagine what it was like in 1960, the ignorance we had of our solar system. I mean, we'd named the planets, but that was more or less as far as we'd got. It's been the great era of exploration the last 50 years, and I think there's still more to do. I think if you want to say, well, I want to do this or that, you know, some specific goal, you know, I want to work on Mars exploration, I think that's a very dangerous goal to have. I have a goal, I want to work in space research. If it happens to involve Mars, okay, but I'm going to convince myself that it happens to involve Saturn, okay too. Or even if it involved building space telescopes. Or even if it involved looking at the Earth from space. These are all quite as exciting as each other. the challenges of doing things in space, for me, are terrific. And so I would not be too fussy about the target so much as I'd say, get into space technology, make sure you understand a bit of the engineering as well as the science, and you can have, you'll never regret it. You have to get to my job, I was just lucky. I mean, you know, it's just happened to be in the right place at the right time. But I've always liked to have multiple choices in front of me. And so don't close down on a single target. Keep your mind open. Have five or six things you'd like to do. And with a 20% success rate, you'll over-succeed with six goals. Okay?
Well, that's some good food for thought. Thanks very much for taking time out of your day to speak with us.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
We just listened to John's interview with David Southwood from the European Space Agency, and wow, what a career he has had. And I'm sure he'll continue to do stuff even though he's retired from the ESA. Maybe we can start with what they started with in the interview, which was the Cassini mission. I found it fascinating, for example, that it was 20 years in the making and then launched in 1997, and now it's going to go probably till 2017 at least, if not longer than that.
It's always been a very exciting mission. The fact that Huygens actually found methane lakes and rivers was a wonderful result and really exciting. And of course, Cassini's taken a wealth of incredible pictures that are defining Saturn now.
If our listeners haven't looked at them, I urge them to go to the Cassini website and have a look at the images, because they are striking photos that they've gotten, in addition to all the other science that has been done. But the
this is just visual imagery. That alone has been incredibly worthwhile,
right?
Let alone the actual science.
We recommend, and we see these pictures, these photographs coming back from the probes, but as Dr. Southwood mentions, a lot of tremendously valuable information has come from things like magnetometry and radar.
Right.
And the other instruments on board. And there's a whole lot of things that we're learning about those worlds that you only get to do if you can plan out these missions that take two or three decades to make happen.
It's an incredible effort and an international effort, right? It wasn't just the ESA working on this.
Oh, well, that's right. And Dr. Southwood, working as he was right up at the top levels of ESA as director of science, he's right immersed in that need to do international collaboration and to set up the institutional structures that enable these kinds of things. And it's impressive that we can make things work for decades on end in that framework. And it's a really interesting story to see someone whose background is in science but who has learned how to work on that stage and has seen the tremendous relevance that that has.
Surviving amongst politicians.
Yeah, but also, you know, learning to build those relationships internationally. This is difficult to do, but it's essential for a mission like Cassini or for future Mars exploration.
Because you're seeing all of these space agencies' budgets are getting cut here and there, and all these missions, we want to do more and more, so it costs more and more, so you have to work together to get it done, or else you can't just rely on...
Every year, everyone's budgets change, sometimes a little bit, sometimes a lot.
Right, so it's a give and take, like David Southwood mentioned in the interview. There was those years where it was thought Cassini might not make it, they might not launch, but they had the collaboration with NASA, and NASA kind of came through for them in that time.
Yeah, and he mentions the importance of being able to trust your partners in international collaboration and of the value of those commitments. I was struck as well in the case of Cassini how the solution was partly political, but partly technical. They actually redesigned the mission architecture a little bit to use a non-scanning platform on the spacecraft. So they had to change the way that the spacecraft is maneuvered and the way that the instruments are mounted, but nonetheless it allowed a much cheaper and therefore feasible mission. The other thing that's interesting for me is to see a representative of ESA talking about the need for international cooperation and the way that works, because the agency itself, the European agency, only works because it's a collaboration between 19 countries.
That's right.
Yeah. And so that need to trust and to work together and to have stable commitments has informed the whole way that that agency is built and the funding models that they use to support these missions. Mm-hmm. So certainly the Europeans know something about international collaboration.
And I mean, we've seen this in the past with space exploration, with the International Space Station, for example. I mean, that is the largest international project on, well, I don't want to say on Earth because it's not on Earth, but it just shows that that kind of collaboration is possible and necessary for these things to happen. I was just at a class actually today where we did the human space debate, where should we be sending humans into space or just robots or none of the above, and to bring that up to say that the International Space Station and other space missions are being done with collaborations between multiple countries, I think that's a really great thing to model for the next generation.
So France and Germany used to go to war every few decades, and now they jointly operate the Columbus Lab and the automated transfer vehicle and the European effort in space, and together with the other partners, the whole human spaceflight project. And if we can solve that problem with human spaceflight, well, what can't we do?
Yeah, space is a frontier that can bring us all together.
Yeah.
It unites everyone. We all have the same border up there.
Yeah.
And I think especially in the time of things like recession and budget cuts, I think it's really important to have many countries on board, have same strategies of fulfilling the same dreams. I think everyone at the end of the day wants to find life somewhere. So if everyone is on board for the same mission, have same ideas, and I think using budgets from different countries can probably work better than just one country working towards it.
And it makes sense too, right? Because one year, you know, NASA's budget is going to be cut, and maybe the next year it won't be, but then another space agency could come in and kind of make up for that fact.
Yeah.
And so you're not just relying on your government to fund something.
Yeah, and there's tremendous value, I think, in the systematics of making a project like planetary exploration work, of diversity, of having groups from, you know, with several different funding models, with several different tax bases, with several different motivations, and so that if one funding structure fails, or if one state fails to provide what they were going to, you can still have something that looks similar to the initial plan, or at least that will succeed. He also makes some really interesting comments, I think, about the need to see your work in the broader context. He talks about not having a single specific goal for your career.
I really, really like that piece of advice, because I think as, you know, students get higher in their education levels, you get into master's, you get your PhD, you kind of focus on this little tiny slice of the pie, and to kind of not say, I want to study this rock on Mars, you could say, I want to study geology somewhere in the solar system. That really opens a lot more doors.
Yeah, and you never know where those doors are going to be, right? You know, if you're someone who can only open doorknobs that are 1.3 meters above the floor, there's a limit to what you can go through. But if you know how to find every kind
David
of door,
Southwood can open a wide variety of doorknobs at various heights, and that has taken him all the way to Saturn.
So yeah,
it's clearly been a successful strategy for him.
Absolutely, and plus in space, everything is going to be interdisciplinary. You're not going to be able to only talk to other people who do this particular kind of geology. You're going to have to talk to other geologists and to other scientists and to people who are engineers and policymakers and to the public.
Right.
So the ability to understand science and engineering and policy and what else, you know, this is the kind of thing that enables careers and enables the kind of projects that Dr. Southwood has worked on.
Mm-hmm. And I think in general, in our world, that's the way things are going, to an interdisciplinary nature. You can't just know your one little area and expect to just stay in that area forever and ever. You know, people, you have to work with, like you said, with other types of people, other scientists, other engineers, business people, politicians.
Mm-hmm.
So I also heard there was this quote where it says that you should be always ready for a career that does not exist right now. So few years ago, there were no extrasolar planets to, few decades ago, there were no extrasolar planets to study. Now there's a whole vast field of people working towards it, so...
Right, and not all those people went to get their PhD in extrasolar planets, right?
Yeah.
I mean, those people were studying maybe the atmosphere on Earth and decided, hey, look, we can look at atmospheres of other planets around other stars.
So I think you should always be ready for expanding your career to different avenues as time takes, because you cannot predict what's going to happen in the next 25 years, what kind of technology we would have.
Yeah, and there's something else which I don't know if it comes from the fact that working in space is just that inspiring, or if it's an attitude particular to Dr. Southwood and some others. But he speaks with, I would say without excitement, but with great passion and wonder about the things that he's looking at.
Yeah, and he's looked at things on Earth and in our atmosphere, and he's done it all. He's been all over the solar system.
Yeah, and certainly, if you have that much drive, that much passion of motivation, if you continue to be filled with that much wonder after decades of working in it, then I would think that this will enable you to go a long way in your career.
There's a lot more work to be done yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting also, besides Cassini, to see the great flowering of diversity in missions that ESA has been able to participate in in the last decade or two.
I find it really great in the time of, with NASA getting its budget cut a little bit, or a lot, I guess, from the planetary science aspect, that he is committed and ESA is committed to still move forward with these missions. For example, the Mars missions in 2016 and 2018, I believe you talked about specifically. Even though NASA was a big partner in that, they're still going to go ahead. Because who knows, maybe in 2 years or 5 years or 10 years, NASA will come back.
These missions take 20 years to plan. You have to take the long view.
Right.
Absolutely, yeah. And during the development of what ESA calls the ExoMars program, they've already had to reformulate a little bit and change their plans and bring the Americans on board as a partner and split one mission into two. So it's entirely possible that they will find a way of making this work that may look very different from what we see now.
He didn't talk specifically about those missions, did he? Can someone give a summary of what they plan to do with those two missions, the 2016-2018?
So 2016 was planned. So let's say the plan as of 6 months ago. The 2016 would have been an orbiter, the ExoMars Trace Gas Orbiter, what they were calling TGO. And this is to look at gases in the atmosphere of Mars that are at very small concentrations. One of the biggest suspects is methane, because there have been some suggestions that there is methane in the atmosphere, and the explanation for that is still open.
Right.
Yeah.
They're thinking maybe, though...
Well, methane shouldn't last forever in the Martian atmosphere, so either there's active geology, there's some volcanism or something, or there's some, what Dr. Southwood very carefully calls an organic process happening on the surface actively to generate methane sometime in the last recent number of years. So TGO would have looked at that and any other gases in the atmosphere, and actually would have carried an instrument jointly produced by Canada and JPL using the optical system that's already in Earth orbit on the Canadian SciSat mission that carries a Fourier transform spectrometer to look at fine concentrations of gases in the Earth's atmosphere. They're basically looking for pollution on Earth.
Okay.
We would be looking to see fine concentrations of gases on Mars. 2018 would have been another rover, this one with a ground-penetrating radar and a drill, a whole suite of other instruments. And this would have demonstrated a European landing capability. And in fact, I think there was to be some kind of simple lander demonstrator in 2016. To ride along with TGO. So that was the plan, and the Americans were going to provide instrumentation and other assistance, including launch services, and a significant part of the funding envelope. So as it stands, that's the reason that these are in doubt at this point. But they're looking at partnerships with Russia and elsewhere, and so we'll see what it means.
These plans don't just go away. They can evolve into something else, something perhaps better, even if it's somewhere down the line.
Or even, if it's delayed by 2 or 3 or 5 years,
Mars isn't going anywhere.
That's
right. Although, the people who have put a lot of work into this project for the last 10 years, they might be going somewhere.
Right.
So, and this is part of the reason for the disappointment. But yeah, Mars isn't going anywhere, and if there are interesting organic processes on Mars, if they've lasted this long, they may be there in 2018 still.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. 6 years, they probably won't get wiped out.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, in any case, it's a concept that Dr. Southwood mentions with great passion, the merit of looking at trace gases in the atmosphere as a precursor to future work. And so something like that will, I would say, very likely happen sooner or later.
Mm-hmm. He does talk about a few times, I think, during the interview about really the motivation for doing all these missions is to seek out organic processes or life, we can say that, it's okay.
Yeah.
On other planets or moons. And he talked a bit about the icy moons as well, mostly about the icy moons of Saturn.
Yeah,
Saturn and Jupiter both.
Yeah, that's what Cassini is looking at.
Yeah.
And Cassini's opened up some new horizons there. Of course, Titan would be a terribly interesting world to land an actual rover on, swim around in some methane lakes.
Methane lakes, that'd be cool.
Yeah, or even aircraft. The atmosphere is so thick that you could easily, it's like 1.5 times the pressure here at Earth. You could imagine sending lighter or heavier than air aircraft.
Yeah.
And you could cover a lot of ground with a balloon or an airplane on Titan. Or a boat.
the seal in the soup.
Yeah.
That, maybe a I don't know, that probe and the landing was pretty spectacular. When those images came out of...
Yeah, that was extremely exciting.
Of the lakes.
The Huygens probe?
Yeah, it was really, really cool.
Yeah, and you know, you have images every short interval during the descent, and so you actually can see the lakes and the mountains, and then you zoom down to them and you're looking at this one rock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
And I think it will be very interesting to see if, well, there have been studies where they suggest there might be liquid form of whatever there is, methane or...
Methane, you know, and ethane,
methane, yeah. A kilometer or below that thick icy region. So if a thing like a submarine is launched, you'd probably be able to study a lot about the interior of this icy moon.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of speculative work that was described at the recent Lunar and Planetary Science Conference about that, for want of a better word, hydrology of Titan. The way that, because a lot of the solid mass surrounding the lake, the sand and the dunes and the mountains are made probably of solid methane and ethane. But then you have the liquid stuff which is percolating through and getting sorted and flowing. And trying to understand how that works, you know, right now a lot of it is speculation based on the overall data set and this one sequence of images from Huygens.
Yeah. When they landed Huygens, they didn't know what kind of surface it would be landing on.
Right.
If it would be really spongy or hard or soft.
Or liquid.
Oh, yeah.
And plan for all this.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating about, I mean, Cassini and all the Mars missions and just, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, we were searching for life or whatever. People were like, oh, you know, you're not going to find water anywhere else in the solar system. And now we have all these places that have...
Yeah, Europa and
water in, you know, liquid ice form. Mm-hmm. And now people are like, oh, you're never going to find, you know, organic processes on other. So you never know. We're always finding out new things. And it's pretty amazing how far we've come in that in the last 15, 20 years.
Yeah, Dr. Southwood describes the great ignorance that we had about the solar system when he started his career.
Right. He was like, oh, we had some planets and some rocks and that was about it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so just imagine how much there is still to learn if we keep doing these kind of missions in the next few decades.
So if we can get under the surface of Europa or Enceladus and see what's down there, if we can get more onto the surface of Titan, continue exploring Mars, all sorts of amazing things that we can have yet to discover.
And talk about a challenge. I mean, so Europa might have an ocean down there.
Yeah.
But
we just have to dig through
all that ice.
Kilometers of ice.
Plus,
how many? We don't even know.
No, we don't know.
You know, or Enceladus in this case, where it probably doesn't have an ocean, but there's some amount of water that's able to be free for these geysers or these plumes.
Yeah. What a great way to push technology forward is to overcome these problems, right?
I'll tell you, if you want to make me have something exciting to do, put me on one of those projects.
Right.
You know, and
even if you spend 20 years on it, you'll still
I would never stop being excited to work on something like that.
Yeah.
So all of these possibilities and you know, the work that it would take to find those answers, there's a lot to do.
Yeah, I hope we can do it in our lifetime.
Likewise.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host John Moores. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Dave Kirsch, Raymond Francis, Parshati Patel, and Alyssa Gilbert. Our editors were John Moores and Michael Forster. And, as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on Astronomy.fm.